So hopefully that as we go through this, everyone can follow along at the presentation. And but I can say a little bit the genesis of the origin of my study of this sutta is that I'm very fond of this saying that I understood it before, nothing whatsoever is worth clinging to. That's the way I liked it. And now I translate it differently, but I've taught it and just repeated it, and I thought it was really great. And then about a year ago or so, I thought, well, I want to find out the actual passage. Where is it in the suttas? And so I found it in this text. I don't think I had read this text before, that were text for today. And so I thought that was kind of a somewhat strange text and interesting. And as I looked at it, I said, wait, this has this literary structure that I've been familiar with in a few other suttas. And as far as I know, no one's ever reported or written about this structure in the Buddhist texts. It's a structure that was first found in Homer in the late, maybe 1870s, maybe. They found it in Homer, they found it in the Bible, and then they found it all over the place. It's a lot of different cultures. It seems to be particularly prominent in oral cultures around the world. And maybe it's a natural kind of structure for the human mind to operate under. I've seen the structure as being similar to structure to how rituals can be structured. That you go into the ritual, there's a pivotal point in the ritual where something happens, and then you return to the world again. And so it's maybe it's a a structure that's deep in human culture, the human mind that is being replicated in these the composition of these kinds of texts. And I think of it as a storyteller's technique. And so this is so what we have here in this text is the narrator of the text has a huge role in the text we have. The tradition is that all the suttas came from Ananda, because Ananda accompanied the Buddha everywhere, and Ananda has a very good memory. So he memorized everything, and he's like the court reporter. So of course, whatever was written down by Ananda, that's how it happened. But that's a fairly naive piece of orthodox teaching that all the suttas come from the Buddha and we can rely on them just whatever says there is the Buddha's teachings. And one of the things that stands out in the sutta on the shorter discourse on the destruction of craving, it has this literary structure and it has a lot of elements that is the words of the narrator, not the words of any of the characters. And so we have, now we have someone's creativity, and everyone remembers things in selective ways and presents it in ways that they want to present something for sometimes for a larger purpose. And the question is, for what purpose was this particular text composed? And some of this involved the Buddha teaching something, but so maybe Ananda was there, but there's no evidence that Ananda went with Mogliana, this monk, to Sakka's heaven, and to see what was going on, to do his court reporting, and capture it and be ready. So, how did he learn this if it was Ananda? But more likely, what we'll see is this text was written many centuries after, as we have it, many centuries after the Buddha lived. And so, one of the fascinating things about this text for me is how it's a very clear example of something that could not have come from the Buddha's time. And so, it puts a big question mark between all the suttas. Do we naively accept them all as teachings of the Buddha, or can we find evidence for historical stratifications of the texts that were written early, middling, or fairly late in the history of the composition of these texts? And how late were they written, some of these composed? Were they composed? In the last little piece, I'll say that the earliest really concrete evidence for the middle length discourse, for example, as a collected body of work in the form that we have today, is not until some point in the 5th century, the Common Era. So about 1,000 years after the Buddha is when we get, you know, real evidence that we can rely on dating, that this book existed at that time. And so 1,000 years is a long time for things to change. And there's a very, you know, strong wish among Theravadan Buddhists to believe that this has been unchanged since the time of the Buddha. There's an interesting phenomena that we see through looking at Chinese translations of sutras, text. And that is, we see that in Sanskrit versions of certain texts, that over the centuries, they were added to and changed. But the Chinese, when they translated a text into Chinese, a Buddhist text, they tended to preserve it the way it was translated. They didn't change that then anymore. So I did my dissertation on a sutra that was translated into Chinese in the year 179. But the Sanskrit version that we have that survives of this text, the earliest manuscript, I don't remember anymore now, but it's a text that was probably completed about 1,000 years later. So the year 1100 or something. And there's a lot of additions to it. It's changed a lot since 179. And so in India, there's no evidence of what the text looked like in Sanskrit in the beginning of the Common Era. But that was saved in China. And what we see is that there are some ways in which staying faithful to a text and keeping it exactly how it was passed down was not something that people were in India were particularly inclined to do when it came to Buddhist sutras. And when I did my dissertation, it was on Mahayana sutras. And it didn't occur to me to apply this principle to the Pali Canon at first. I thought, surely that must be a fairly consistent, you know, unchanged kind of body of texts. But as I've been studying it more and more, there's no reason to think that's the case, that the Pali Canon is quite fluid, these texts. And it just happens to be that ones we have might well, very well be the accident or the coincidence of when it was written down. And when it was written down in a form that survived down to the present, or when it was selected by someone to be put into the middle length discourse, and then this famous teacher Buddhaghosa, he wrote his commentary about that text. So once he wrote the commentary about the middle length discourse, it wasn't going to change anymore. And so it's relatively stable. But there's been some changes since then, and give you an example of how these Buddhist texts can change over the years, even in the modern era. In 1954, there was this sixth council of Buddhist monks to talk about the suttas, the canon. And there was a big deal. The Theravadan monks came from all kinds of Theravadan countries, and they didn't want to come to Burma for this meeting until the Burmese had someone in Burma who could recite from memory the entire canon. And there was one monk who took that task on and learned to memorize it, so he could go to that council and recite the whole thing from memory. And then later he started a school in Burma teaching this to other people. And so they met and they reviewed all the suttas, the different versions they had, kind of to standardize them, I suppose. And at some point during that conference, they decided that they saw that they saw, they knew that the in the long discourses of the Buddha, there's the greater discourse on the foundations of mindfulness. And then there's the ordinary discourse in the middle length discourses, ordinary discourse on the foundation of mindfulness. The greater one has a long explanation about Four Noble Truths. That's many pages long. And that's absent in the version of the discourse on the four foundations of mindfulness in the middle length discourses. And at that council, they decided that was kind of a mistake. It must have dropped out someplace. So they took the long commentary about the Four Noble Truths from the long version and stuck it into the short version. So now the Burmese version of that text has, you know, is just the same length as the one in the long discourses. So this is an example of how people decided how to change a sutta. And that's how it's now presented in Burma, and that change. So what I'm trying to say is suttas change, and they're fluid, and they would probably, if I was going to venture a guess, and you know, at least 90%, if not 99%, of the different versions of suttas that have existed in India down through the centuries did not survive. And so sometimes we have only one version that survives, and that's in the Pali Canon. Sometimes we have different versions that survive in Chinese, some in Gandhari, a language of ancient kind of Pakistan area. And so we have, you know, different these ancient suttas surviving in different languages. But even the ones that survive are probably just a small percentage of what actually existed at some point. And so we have these, but we have some texts, and it's phenomenal what we have. And to really understand what's going on there in some historically accurate way takes textual archaeology. And some of that textual archaeology is no different than an archaeologist taking a brush and slowly brushing away the dirt, and maybe finding one little bead or one little piece of evidence that they, from which they can construct the story of a civilization or something. And so it's a little bit of a thankless task to kind of dive down into these suttas, but to get some kind of historical understanding of them, it takes a lot of careful work. And so that, you know, I don't say that my study of this text here was as careful as it could have been, but it, for some of you, was probably more careful than you care for. And so what I want to start with is, so the text that we're looking at is called the Shorter Discourse on the Destruction of Craving. And it has this famous line, "Nothing whatsoever is worth clinging to, being attached to." It has a prequel in the long discourses called Sakka's Questions. And both of these texts involve the god Sakka going to talk to the Buddha. And in the long discourses, the one there, Sakka's Questions, Sakkapanna, Questions of Sakka, the Buddha is sitting in Sakka's cave. Apparently Sakka had a cave, and so he's sitting there meditating, and Sakka doesn't want to really wake the Buddha up out of his meditation. Wants to be very careful and respectful. So he asks a kind of a Gandhaba. Gandhaba is kind of like a heavenly musician to go and sing a song to kind of wake the Buddha up so that the Brahma might go, Sakka can go and ask the Buddha a question. And you don't really get sense of, at least some of the English translations of the song that this heavenly musician sings is kind of erotic. It's kind of describes the beautiful body parts of the heavenly musician lady that he's in love with and that he's hoping to marry. And he talks about his love for this woman to be as devoted as an arhat is devoted to the Dharma. It's kind of, in terms of the Pali, it's kind of like a wild thing. It's like going and going up to the Pope to get his attention and playing the Doors and "Come on, baby, light my fire." And it's a little unusual. So it's kind of a fun, strange kind of text to have this erotic kind of song that's being sung to the Buddha. And the Buddha kind of comes out of his meditation, is very polite, and says, "That was a nice song you sang." And then there's a lot more goes on. But then the heavenly musician says, "Sakka wants to talk to you." And the Buddha says, "Sure." And Sakka asks all these questions. And the last questions he asks gets a reply that kind of begs a next question. But Sakka doesn't ask the next question. So now I'll show you the PowerPoint slide. How to construct a sutta to evoke wonder and amazement. Maybe that's the purpose of some of these texts. So just keep that in mind. And so then here is one of the earliest pieces of Buddhist art, or Buddhist art from the earliest phase we have it. This is from Bodh Gaya, where the Buddha was enlightened. So there's these friezes, these rock engravings that survive. And during that time, there's a lot of them in some of these ancient stupas that exist and temples that were made. And here, I don't know if you can see my cursor, but here is the cave. It's relatively small. It looks like it has a seat inside of it. And this is Sakka's cave. And here on the side, the person you see there is Sakka. And he's, I think it's Sakka or it's that heavenly musician. So I can't tell what the person has in their hand here, if that's a lute of some kind or... But anyway, so here's the Buddha. And during that time, we don't know quite why, but the Buddha was not depicted in these kinds of artwork. So here it's an empty chair. But this is the little cave that he was meditating in when the musician sang his musical instrument and his song, and Sakka came and questioned the Buddha. So why I'm showing you this, this comes from the first century before the Common Era. And the story of long discourses, the questions of Sakka, was important enough in the Buddhist milieu at that point that they made carvings of it. And here you see. Let's see. There. And here we see it again. This is a little bit harder to tell. You have to kind of believe me. If you see the arch here going around, all the way around, kind of, it's broken off part of it. This is the cave as well. And there's people sitting on the side here kind of worshiping. And here we have a throne, a seat on the throne. And again, they're not going to show the Buddha because at that era, the first century before the Common Era, they didn't do that. So it gets, again, this is a picture of, and it's called Indra's Sala, Guha. Guha means cave, and Indra is another name for Sakka. And Bharut is one of the great stupas that survived from ancient India. And there was lots of friezes, lots of carved images on sculpture, on the gates and the walls and different places. And here we have Sakka's cave again. So it was again, it was important. It was an important story at the time. And here we have the second century Common Era in Mathura, another place where Buddhist art, one of the first places in India where depictions of the actual Buddha appeared. And here we have Buddha again in the cave. And to the right here is Sakka. And to the left is the heavenly musician singing erotic songs. And he's holding his lute here. So this is an important story. And then, let's see. So in Majjhima 21, Sakka asks to talk to the Buddha. And then the Buddha said, thought to himself, for a long time now, this spirit, meaning Sakka, has led a pure life. Any question he asks me will be beneficial, not unbeneficial. And he will quickly understand any answer I give to his question. So the Buddha addressed Sakka in verse. Ask me your question, Vasava, whatever you want. I'll solve each and every question you have. Let's see. Oh, I know what I can do. I can this one. So then. And so here's Sakka's first question to the Buddha in that long discourse 21. Having been granted an opportunity by the Buddha, Sakka asked the first question. Good fellow, what fetters bind the gods, humans, titans, dragons, centaurs, and any other diverse creatures, so that, though they wish to be free of enmity, violence, hostility, and hate, they still have enmity, violence, hostility, and hate. So these kinds of questions makes the suttas timeless, because some of these issues are current in our society today. So this should be interesting. You know, what keeps people bound, attached, so that they're caught up in enmity, violence, hostility, and hate? And the Buddha answered him this way, Lord of gods, the fetters of jealousy and stinginess bind the gods, humans, titans, dragons, centaurs, and any of the other diverse creatures, so that, though they wish to be free of enmity, violence, hostility, and hate, they still have enmity, violence, hostility, and hate. So jealousy and stinginess is here identified as an underlying condition for these painful states that people have. So that's his answer. And then there's about 14 questions and answers that go on in the text between Sakka and the Buddha. And Sakka's last question is this. Good fellow, have all ascetics and Brahmins reached the ultimate end, the ultimate sanctuary from the yoke, the ultimate spiritual life, the ultimate goal? And the Buddha answers, no. Only those bhikkhus who are liberated in the destruction of craving are the ones who have reached the ultimate end, the ultimate security from bondage, the ultimate holy life, the ultimate goal. So here's the Buddha's answer. And then it seems like maybe the obvious question is, well, how do you do that? How are you liberated by the destruction of craving? How do you reach the ultimate end? The Buddha, that answer is, that question is not asked in the long discourses, but Sakka does ask it in Majjhima 37. How, in brief, is a bhikkhu liberated in the destruction of craving? One has reached the ultimate end, the ultimate security from bondage, the ultimate holy life, the ultimate goal, one who is foremost among gods and humans. So that last passage, the last phrase, is not in the long discourse 21, but the rest of it is pretty comparable. I think maybe, yeah, here I'm comparing them. What's bold is the same. And the so maybe I did I skip. Yeah, so there is so in Sukha, in this shorter discourse on the destruction of craving, this is where Sukha finally gets a chance to ask the Buddha this question. And now what's interesting about these texts is that if you remember, in Diga 21, the Buddha was praised Sukha for living a pure life. He asks a question, he'll understand quickly to great benefit. And eventually in Long Discourse 21, Sukha becomes a stream enter, or says he's a stream enter. So he's like a hot guy. He's a good practitioner. It's any teacher's, wonderful, students. We don't get that impression of Sukha in Majjhima 37. Majjhima 37, he seems totally caught up in his sensual pleasures. And he asks this important question, and then he shows no interest or has no effect on him, seemingly. And that's part of it's very strange that Sukha is portrayed this way in this text. It's almost like a satire, maybe, or it's very pointed. It's very different than Sukha is usually depicted in the suttas, which is much more respectful. And why has Sukha changed so dramatically between these two suttas? The composers of, clearly it's a different milieu, maybe, or a different time, or a different reason. Or sometimes I look at these texts and wonder if Majjhima 37 is trying to make a kind of a satire, a parody of Majjhima 20, of Diga 21. And it certainly seems like it's humorous and strange. And what's the purpose for this? So that's part of the drama that's going on here, maybe. So I've talked now for a while, and there's more to do, more slides and more talking to be done. But do we want to pause for a moment and give you a chance to ask questions or make comments of what I've said so far? Otherwise, it's just too much information all at once, maybe. Yes, Cody.
I noticed some interesting connections in Stephen Batchelor's recent book, where he talks about the intersection between the Greeks and the Buddhists of India. He gives a little explanation as to why they didn't, or why they started depicting the Buddha instead of showing kind of the absence of. And I found it interesting that you mentioned that this particular storytelling modality was something that was inherited from other cultures as well. So I wonder if this is a later addition, if that was a result of that cultural exchange that resulted in the Buddha starting to be depicted differently in statues and whatnot.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I never thought of that way. I kind of assumed that it wasn't borrowed from somewhere else, but rather it spontaneously arises in different cultures, this kind of thing, because it's so pervasive and all over the world. But your idea, it is found in Homer, which is very important for the Greeks. So, is it a technique that maybe was borrowed from, because the Greeks were making their way to India, to the edges of India. They were up there in what's now Pakistan for a long time. So that might be interesting things to consider, but I don't know how we're going to solve that. But it's very hard to kind of understand the origins and where these texts were composed. But there is some kind of strong suggestion that it was probably composed in Western, kind of northwestern India. So not too far away from where the Greeks were. Mike?
Is it okay to ask a question that kind of skips ahead a bit?
Well, you can ask, but if I have permission not to answer,
Okay.
Or put off the answer until we get to it.
So your essay mentions that kind of symmetric structure.
Yeah.
And there is something in there about the, so we hear the Buddha's answer twice in the audio recording and in the text of the translation. And when I was both listening to it, the audio recording and reading the text, I was surprised that when Moggallana returns to the Buddha, we don't get it a third time.
Oh, that's strange. I didn't notice that. This is they're reading Sujata's translation.
Yeah.
And so maybe Sujata chose not to include that because it seemed for him, it just seems too redundant. I mean, there's a patience issue among Western audiences.
Okay.
And there's an idea of repetition is not so, especially when you read it, why do I bother? It's like I got the point. And but if you're chanting and singing these songs and performing them, the refrain of a song is as important as the other lyrics. You don't get tired of the refrain. So I think in the oral culture, there was a very different receptivity for the repetition than we have. So I suspect that Sujato just didn't include it. And
okay.
Because it's in Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation. It's also in the Pali that I've looked at.
That was my question was. Okay,
yeah,
so it
yeah.
does appear the third time there.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. So before we go further into this text, I want to introduce you to these texts that were mentioned as maybe precursors to Majjhima 37. And there's one text in the Connected Discourses of the Buddha, chapter 51, Sutta 14, and the title is Moggallana. And at one time, the Blessed One was dwelling at Sabati in the mansion of Migara's mother. So that's the same place where Buddha is living in Majjhima 37. Now, on that occasion, a number of bhikkhus who dwelt on the ground floor of the mansion were restless, puffed up, personally vain, rough-tongued, rambling in their talk, muddle-minded, without clear comprehension, unconcentrated, scatterbrained, loose in their faculties. Wow. I mean, this is serious kind of misbehavior. I mean, they could have just said there's a bunch of monks being, restless down there, but they really go into it. And it makes me, it's kind of strange. And the Buddha was supposed to be like this phenomenally effective teacher who could just get people enlightened just listening to his talks. And here the monks who are living in the same house as him are behaving this way. That's, it's quite a story to tell. It's almost hard to believe that this is the case. And then the Blessed One addressed the Venerable Mahamoggallana thus, Moggallana, your brothers in the holy life dwelling on the ground floor of Megara's mother's palace are restless and so forth, loose in their faculties. Go, Moggallana, stir up a sense of urgency in these bhikkhus. And the sense of urgency is a word that Pali, some of you know, samvega, a sense of, like we got to practice. And yes, Venerable Sir, the Venerable Mahamoggallana replied. Then he performed a feat of spiritual power such that he made the mansion of Megara's mother shake, quake, and tremble with his toe. Then those bhikkhus, shocked and terrified, stood to one side and said, it is wonderful indeed, it is amazing indeed, sir. There is no wind, and this mansion of Megara's mother's has a deep base and is securely planted, immobile, unshaking, yet it shook, quaked, and trembled. Then the Blessed One approached those bhikkhus and said to them, why, bhikkhus, are you standing to one side shocked and terrified? And they explained what had happened. Bhikkhu's Bhikkhu Mogliana, desiring to stir up a sense of urgency in you, made the mansion shake, quake, and tremble with his toe. What do you think? By having developed and cultivated what things has the Bhikkhu Mogliana become powerful and mighty? So here he has, they got the monk's attention. I mean, they really got shocked at, you know, the quaking and shaking. And so they have a sense of urgency. And so they're ready to get teaching. And what does he teach them? How Mogliana was so powerful and mighty that he could shake the palace, his psychic powers, what he had. He didn't offer them liberation teaching. It's a little bit strange, I think. That's what, and then the rest of the text is all about what they should do to develop, or what it took to develop these powers that allow you to use your toe to shake a palace. I probably never, none of you ever thought that you wanted to develop that power before, and now you have something to look forward to. It's one part of the Dharma to be able to do that. So this story, including the palace of Megara's mother, the mansion, is very close to the second act of Majjhima 37, where someone, Mahamogliana, recognizes that someone, Sakka, doesn't have enough sense of urgency, spiritual urgency, and so he decides to kind of wake him up, and he touches his toe and shakes the palace and gets his attention so that he'll listen to some kind of teachings or do something. He'll remember the Buddha's teachings. So it's very similar, except the characters are changed. And here now, things that Sakka, the Buddha, what, you know, so to some degree, it's all this change here. And Sakka is the same as the restless monks. So it's relatively easy to see this story, Mahamogliana, that might have been the precursor for the second act in Majjhima 37. That seems like almost the same story, kind of. And then we have in the numerical discourses of the Buddha, we have a discourse it's on book 7. And it's the discourse number 61. And in Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation, the title of it is Dozing. And some of you might have, maybe some of you have dozed during meditation. Never, you know, I think it's maybe accidentally happened to me a few times. And on one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling among the Bhagas at Summa Summarigira. Now, on that occasion, Mahamogliana was sitting and dozing. When I was dozing in Japan, sitting a retreat there with the abbot sitting next to me, I was wearing Zen robes with long sleeves, and he would just reach over and yank at my sleeve to wake me up. So that was very nice. So teachers noticed their students dozing and, you know, wanted to do something about it. So it says here, with the divine eye, which is purified and surpasses the human, the Blessed One saw Venerable Mahamogliana sitting and dozing. So he has a kind of telescopic view that he can see things far away with his mind eye, and he saw that Mahamogliana was dozing. And then, just as a strong man might extend his drawn-in arm and draw in his extended arm, or draw in his extended arm, the Blessed One disappeared from the deer park and reappeared before Venerable Mahamogliana. The Blessed One sat down on the seat that was prepared for him and said, so here we have the same story where Mahamogliana goes to Sakka The same way, as quickly as a person can straighten out a bent arm, that's how far long it took the Buddha to travel on in this earth from one place to another. But in Majjhima 37, from Moggallana to go up to the heavens to visit Sakka up there. And then the Buddha gets his attention, shows up, says, "Are you dozing?" And Moggallana says, "Yes, sir." Therefore, Moggallana, you should not attend or attend to or cultivate the object that you were attending to when you became drowsy. By such means, it is possible that your drowsiness will be abandoned. So, if you were doing some meditation practice, don't do while you got drowsy. Don't do that. And then he goes through all kinds of advice of what to do. But if that doesn't work, try this. If that doesn't work, try this. If that doesn't work, try this. He goes through all these things. And then after he tries all these things, then he teaches Mahamoggallana different teachings that are like, you should train yourself thus. We will not approach families for alms with a head swollen with pride. If you train yourself thus, we will not engage in contentious talk. I don't know why that needs to be told to him, but it's just good advice, I suppose. Then the Buddha says, Moggallana, I do not praise bonding with everyone whatsoever, nor do I praise bonding with no one at all. I do not praise bonding with householders and monastics, but I do praise bonding with quiet and noiseless lodgings, far from the flurry of people, remote from human habitation, and suitable for seclusion. So it's kind of interesting. There's a place for bonding with, but you want to bond to a place that's good for meditation rather than to people. So you can have your own opinions about that little teaching. It's a little unusual, maybe, or a little bit. It's not really liberation teaching. Maybe Mahamoggallana was meditating in a noisy social environment and said, maybe you should go somewhere else. But Mahamoggallana was already a senior monk, and the whole teaching is, kind of nice. It's practical and used, but there's no liberation teachings here. And maybe Mahamoggallana was getting a little bit tired of being preached at about all the things you can do to overcome drowsiness. And then Mahamoggallana said to the Blessed One, briefly, Bhante, how is a bhikkhu liberated in the extinction of craving? One who has reached the ultimate conclusion, ultimate end, has won the ultimate security from bondage, lived the ultimate spiritual life, and gained the ultimate consummation. So it's a different translations, but it's the same wording that we've seen in where the Sakka asked the Buddha that question, the same question. So here we have the same question again, and then the Buddha answers like he answers Sakka in Majjhima 37, where the Buddha gives the seven statements, seven steps for becoming fully awakened. So here we have a story that's very similar to the Act One of parts of it, to Act One of Majjhima 37. That of someone going to the Buddha to ask a question about this, asking the very question that was not asked in Long Discourse 21, and then the Buddha gives the same answer that he gives in Majjhima 37. So this maybe suggests that this text here in the numerical discourses is the precursor, is the story that was used to kind of compose Act One in Majjhima 37. The fact that they're using the same words, the same ideas, is more than just a coincidence. Somehow these texts are kind of in relationship to each other, and it's hard to be really sure what the exact relationship with them is, but I think it's fair to have a seriously consider that these two suttas that I just read to you are the material from which Majjhima 37 was put together, or you know, something like that. So now we go back to the slideshow. So here is so the Buddha gives here in the top here, only those bhikkhus who are liberated in the destruction of craving are the ones who have reached the ultimate end, the ultimate security from bondage, the ultimate holy life, the ultimate goal. So that's the Buddha's final answer to Sakka, the 14 questions in the questions of Sakka. And when he gives that final answer, this is what Sakka says. Delighted, Sakka approved and agreed with what the Buddha said, saying, "That's so true, Blessed One. That's so true, Holy One." Hearing the Buddha's answer, I've gone beyond doubt and got rid of indecision. Going beyond doubt and get rid of indecision is kind of a description of stream entry. And so he really understood. It was really beneficial for him. Then he says, turbulence, agitation, sir, is a disease, a boil, a dart. Turbulence drags a person to be regenerated in one state of existence or another. In other words, gets to become reborn. And I bolded this word turbulence. You'll see why, but turbulence is kind of almost a synonym for shake and quake. But here, and then also in Majjhima 21, Sakka as a stream mentor, Sakka said, "I am the Buddha's disciple, a stream mentor, not liable to be reborn in the underworld, destined for awakening. Once upon a time, sir, a battle was fought between the gods and the titans. In that battle, the gods won and the titans lost. It occurred to me as the victor, now the gods shall enjoy both the nectar of the gods and the nectar of the titans." So we have Oja, O-J-A, and here we have E-J-A with long A. It seems very similar. That these are very strong, important words here that's being said, the nectar of the gods. And this Oja, apparently, I've read, is a one way of referring to the soma. And soma was kind of a psychedelic drink that they had in the ancient Vedic times. But then Sakka says this.
Can you share your screen, Gil? It's not.
Oh, I'm not sharing it?
No, it's not at
the moment. Oh, I wish you to. Oh, thank you for telling me. I thought I had. So let me go back and show you. So here's the turbulence is a disease. So Sakka hears his teachings of the Buddha about how to go end craving, become liberated. And his response is to show his insight. He understands something. And turbulence is probably a term that's the final restlessness, final agitation before enlightenment. And it's like probably in English we might say stress, because stress is, for English speakers, is kind of a universal issue that is kind of at the center of almost all things. And so he's using the word turbulence here. And then here, he's talking about having won the battle with the Titans. And now he has this idea that because he's a victor, now he can enjoy this wonderful sensual pleasure, this wonderful nectar of Oja. And so Oja and Eja are almost the same word. But then he has a change of heart about it. "But sir, that joy and happiness of Oja, of this nectar, belongs to the sphere of sticks and swords." It's kind of more of the same, that same world, same as the fighting he had done. "It doesn't lead to disillusionment, dispassion, cessation, peace, insight, awakening, and extinguishment to Nibbana. But the joy and happiness I feel listening to the Buddha's teachings is not in the sphere of the sticks and the sword. It does lead to disillusionment, dispassion, cessation, peace, insight, awakening, and extinguishment. So here, Sakka really has understood well, and he now understands what kind of joy that's worth pursuing and what not. And it's kind of a Dharma joy and happiness that's worth doing, listening to the Dharma. He's not interested in celestial pleasures anymore. This is very different than the Sakka in Majjhima 37, where he also talked about this battle that he won. Once upon a time, a battle was fought between the gods and the Titans. In that battle, the gods won and the Titans lost. When I returned from the battle as a conqueror, a victor, I created the Palace of Victory. The Palace of Victory has 100 towers. And then he goes on and on to talk about all the wonderful towers he has. So here you see a very strong contrast between these two Pali suttas. In the long discourses, Sakka understands the Dharma in a significant way, and he's not going to have anything to do anymore with sensual pleasures, with battles and wars. He's stepping out of that world in order to listen to the Dhamma, in order, you know, because he's become a stream enterer. And in Digha 21, the text presents Sakka as this is his first visit to the Buddha, first time he meets him. And that's all it takes to become a stream enterer. And then Majjhima 37, you get a very different Sakka. And he's not interested in he gets this wonderful liberation teachings, but he doesn't appreciate it. He doesn't delight in it. He doesn't comment on it. Doesn't say that show his own understanding, doesn't claim he has some kind of attainment from it. Instead, he goes back right away and decides to enjoy the palace he built and the pleasures he had and the maidens he has. So it's it's a remarkably different presentation. In Maj 37, when Mogliana realizes that Sakka needs some sense of urgency, Mogliana thought, the spirit lives much too negligently. Why don't I stir up a sense of urgency in him? Then Mogliana used his psychic power to make the Palace of Victory shake and quake and tremble with his big toe. I put in the Pali of shake, sankapeti, because I'm doing a lot of teachings about anukampa, and which I'm translating as care, many of you know. And here you have the same root word, kump. Kump means to shake. So anukampa is the heart shaking or trembling or something in the presence of other people and the suffering of other people, perhaps. So just a... And now here's Sakka in Long Discourse 21. Turbulence is a disease, is a boil, a dart. Turbulence drags a person to be regenerated in one state of existence or another. So this idea of shaking and turbulence really is agitation. It's kind of emphasized in both texts. Yeah, so I think that's the slideshow. And so we have this unusual text, the Majjhima 37, and the way Sakka is depicted is unusual. And if people are familiar with the other texts, and which they probably were from those slides I showed you, the Sakka's questions discourse was fairly popular, was well known, and there's lots more the carvings in India that survive of that cave. All of the caves seem pretty small. When I first read Long Discourse 21 and Buddha meditating in Sakka's cave, I imagine it to be a majestic grotto. just a huge place, and all the depiction of it, it just looks like a little niche, a little cubicle or something in the side of a hill. Not much of a cave for a great god to be living in my mind, but I guess everyone was, you know, used to simpler quarters back then, and we're a little bit humbler than we are today when we want to think of grand things. So now I'll pause and see. We're at the hour, and so I think this was put offered as a 1 hour program. So, you know, if, and then the idea was to spend another half an hour if those who want to stay and take questions and discussion about this. And then I'm going to have another half hour afterwards with a subset of you that are people who have signed up for this new certificate program that we have at IMC, who are doing some kind of ongoing now study. And so we have these two extra times if any of you want to do that. So, so let me turn it over to you first. Now I've talked a lot. Hopefully you could follow and understand a little bit more how unusual Majjhima 37 is. So anything that you'd like to ask or say?
Thank you, Gil. I love this sutta, Majjhima 37. I was introduced to it maybe a year ago. And I find Sakka of the Majjhima very relatable, much more so than in the Digha Nikaya, because he has what I've heard called palace-induced amnesia. I did not make that up. I need to attribute it to Ajahn's Kovilo or Nisibo. I can't remember which one. Uh-huh. But I can very much relate to having profound experiences of hearing these transformative teachings and being like, yeah, wow, I really get it. And then I come back, you know, to my home, and maybe it's not quite like amnesia, but it's so easy to forget, right? And so that part where he, you know, had that palace-induced amnesia, I guess I just love that term. And like I said, I relate to it very much.
Well, be careful. I'm going to shake the computer for you.
But here's the other thing that I think is very interesting, this chiasmatic structure, I guess is how you pronounce it, and how you pointed out that when Moggallana shook Sakka's palace with his toe, that was sort of like the dramatic climax, right? The tension point where, you know, you build up to that, and then that, you know, that happens, and then what, right? And that, I think, for me anyway, ties into something that you didn't mention, which I thought you would, which is how the first time I read this, one of the first things that popped out at me was how basically the fourth tetrad of the Anapanasati Sutta is mentioned here now a couple of times. The fourth tetrad, which mentions, I guess what I think of is like the liberation sequence, right? The Anicca, Viraga, Nirodha, Patanisaga.
Maybe say it in English for people who don't know the Pali.
So the impermanence, dispassion, cessation, and relinquishment, right?
Yeah, and so that's in the middle teachings of the Buddha's description of how to become liberated. Those seven steps,
right?
Yeah.
That's the destruction of craving. That's what happens, right?
Right.
And so it echoes that final tetrad of the Anapanasati. And I don't think it's really found in that exact form, maybe in one or two other suttas that I'm familiar with. But I think that's really significant. And so I guess I'm just wondering what you make of that, or whether you have any ideas about that particular, just the language of the fourth tetrad, and also how it seems to me, as a practitioner, not really a scholar, I'm kind of a scholar wannabe, but really much more of a practitioner, that the first part of that liberation sequence, the anicca or impermanence, I think is maybe what Moggallana was trying to trigger, right? That if Sokka had really paid attention to what he was pointing out, then maybe it would have gone, all the way through that liberation sequence to relinquishment, right? So that's, for me, as I guess a practitioner, something that I found interesting. So I guess that's all I have. I know, and this is maybe a little bit obscure, but I also am curious about why you translated Abhinivesaya as clinging instead of adhering as Bhikkhu Bodhi did, whether there was a conscious decision on your part about that.
So I think there was a lot you said, and yeah, I think there's definitely a literary play here between the middle of the seven steps to liberation, where anicca is at the heart of it, with the shaking of the palace, and I think this is maybe a literary way to give emphasis to the importance of anicca, and now they're doing it in a celestial level. And I can imagine that the worldly audience listening to this would have somehow also gotten some vega, also gotten a sense of urgency to know about this tremendous power that Moggallana has, and feel in awe and wonder, and somehow get some urgency around that. Maybe. Why did I now in this essay, I gave a lot of thought to how to translate this word that I had been reciting to myself as clinging. Nothing's worth clinging to. And I decided that the clinging isn't so good, because the word clinging appears later in a different way. It's in step number five, upadiyati. And so I didn't want to translate the both same word, the same two different Pali words the same way. And I liked clinging a lot. I wanted to keep it. Adhering didn't quite work for me, because in English, in my English, it's too easily to read like adhering means to some kind of belief system, some principle, some doctrine. Adhering, in my mind, associated with doing that rather than with, adhering to my sense of self, my adhering to my hatred or my greed, just kind of doesn't work for me. But I decided, so I in this article, I translated it as attachment, being attached to. And I thought that I was really happy to do that, because in popular English, we often use the word attachment. But this poor word attachment really unused by most translators of Pali texts. It's an orphan word in the Buddhist translation world, and so I thought that that's a good word to use, and it kind of the combination of clinging and adhering. It kind of fits nicely in both, and it's a underused word. So I thought, finally, we can give this poor English word a Buddhist role. So. That's the reason.
And then just briefly, I wonder whether you could just speak to the fourth tetrad and that liberation sequence, and how it's sort of repeated almost verbatim from, the fourth tetrad of the Anapanasati.
I don't think it's verbatim. I mean, the same words and the same sequence, but there each word is embedded in each step. So there's a lot of text that goes around it. I haven't studied this carefully enough to answer your question, but my sense is these four steps repeated frequently in the sutras, are quite common. It's not just Anapanasati Sutta. So to me, it was, of course it's there. It's a standard sequence of descriptions description of the process to awakening. And so I just appreciated it. And so I didn't give it any really more thought, but I think it certainly deserves more thought and consideration, how it works, why it's there. And the way that my mind works around the suttas, for better or for worse, I'm always wondering about what's later and what's earlier, what was composed, the historical strata. And the Anapanasati Sutta, kind of, you know, if I shake it, it sounds like a later sutta that was composed, you know, quite a long time after the Buddha. And the reason I think that is because it's a composite. It's bringing together, it's unifying all these different teachings that existed already to try to unify and show how they can work together. And I think that belongs to a later era. So maybe this idea of these four steps is a later era, and it speaks to the era when Majjhima 37 was starting to be written. But I mean, that's just pure speculation. Great. So then Meg, hi. It's wonderful to see you. Yeah, Meg, it's good. Oops. There you go. Yeah.
Well, actually, I missed most of it because the time change was not 9 hours. It was 8.
Yeah, I learned that this morning.
Preparing for everything. So I didn't really hear most of what you said. But there was one thing that really stumped me. All the monastics that I know have a really exquisite sila. And they would never say anything that was remotely deceptive. And I find it strange that Moggallana was depicted in the second act as using deception when he asked Sakka to relate the teachings so that he could hear them too. He already heard them.
My understanding is that Sakka wasn't asking it for his own sake. He just wanted to know if Sakka, he was curious, did Sakka understand? Did Sakka remember? How important was this?
But in the first act, he was sitting there.
No, but he wants to know if he remembers. He wanted to find out, how do these teachings live in him? Did he remember? Does he stay way close to them?
Yeah. Oh, fine. But then why did he add so that I can hear them too?
Oh, yeah, that's a good question. I like
that. It doesn't make any sense at all. I mean,
maybe. I appreciate your concern, maybe, that one possible justification is that in the ancient world, there were no books. And so they regularly asked each other to repeat the teachings that they already knew so they could hear it again. So it was just a common practice because of the...
Again, was missing.
You can't go to the library and look up the book again.
Yeah.
You have to find someone to recite it for you.
Yeah. Okay.
And I thought that part of the reason why the Buddhist liberation teaching appears used three times in the sutta is because that's also, it's a refrain that really makes a difference in the audience. They hear it, I hear it again, and then they're more likely to remember it.
Yeah, that I totally get.
Yeah.
Okay, great to see you. I hope I'll be able to see the rest of it later.
Yeah, yeah, it's being recorded, so okay. It'll be posted at some point that you everyone can look at it. Yes. So then we have Scott.
Hi, thank you very much, Gil. I had one question, but then something you said raised another question. So the first one is, I thought I heard you say that the Majjhima 37 came together, or it looks like there were aspects of two other suttas, and I missed what the numerical sutta was.
Yes, the numerical sutta is in the book 7, and it's discourse 61, and the title in Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation is Dozing.
Thank you.
Yeah,
and then
these are both referenced in my essay as well, so you'll find the information there too.
Okay, thank you. And the second question then was, you just mentioned that you feel like the Anapanasati was a, you know, amalgam a little bit of earlier teachings, which I heard before. But then I became curious do you have a similar view of 119, mindfulness of the body?
Yeah, I think so. And okay. There also, I think what we seem to have in the three Sati Suttas, the three mindfulness discourses in the Majjhima, the four foundations of mindfulness, the mindfulness of breathing Sutta, and then the mindfulness of the body Sutta. What they have in common is bringing together different lists, different teachings, and harmonizing them, putting them together. And it seems to be at some point a strong tendency to want to show how things work together, hold things together in harmony, in unity. And maybe there was a time when there started to be less unity in the suttas and more argument about what the right practice is and right teachings are. And we do know that in later Buddhism, there became a real heavy divide between mindfulness and concentration practice, jhana practice.
Right.
And I don't know if this is the reason that made 119, but there we see mindfulness combined with a jhana practice. So they're harmonizing those, bringing those together there. So I think it's a part of that unification effort.
All right. Thank you very much.
Mike?
So this seven-step process starts with a quote, hearing that nothing is worth being attached to. And when I read that, I thought, it's not that easy. Just hear it. And so I'm wondering if there's something about either Buddhist culture or the translations or something that I'm missing that would cause me to misunderstand what they're trying to say.
So hearing nothing is worth being attached to, that's confusing for you? Or all the steps are confusing?
What's confusing is, yeah, I could hear this. Is it going to lead to enlightenment? Well, no, only if I start practicing.
Please be patient with me. I couldn't quite hear what you said. Can you say it again?
Okay. So the text seems to say, all you have to do is hear something and boom, 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 these things will happen automatically and you're done.
Yes.
All right. Clearly it's not that easy. So I'm wondering, what am I missing about this?
Yes. Good question. Excellent question. So you better be ready to write this down, memorize, chant it, the answer I gave you. You should probably go and spend 3 months doing the 3-month retreat at IMS. And then maybe the 10 days before the end, have someone read you this statement. Nothing's worth clinging to. Nothing's worth being attached to. Your mind will be maybe so fertile, so ready, so prepared to understand how this can apply every moment of your life that there's nothing to cling to, nothing to hold on to. And your life has become so simplified in that retreat context that it's really easy to see the moment-to-moment flow of attachment and freedom from it. And you've heard nothing is worth clinging to. And now you're hanging out right there on the edge between clinging and non-clinging. And it's all you need for the rest of this process just to unfold on its own.
Okay.
So you have to prepare yourself for it. You don't just go, watch Netflix and then open the book and say, how does this work? Ash.
Thanks, Gil, for this. I'm in that same vein of the seven things that the Buddha, gives the instruction in. In the middle of it, it doesn't seem like it's just boom, 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 everything will happen. For me, I read the key piece in number four, where we're abiding in observation or meditation of the inconstancy of that which is pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral sensation. And I think that's the easy thing to forget. And the humbling thing about this sutta is that even the great Indra can be made to look like a fool as a, you know, as a consumer of, you know, craving of these palaces filled with nymphs and so forth. And so anyway, that's what I draw out of it. Like the kernel in there in the middle, the earth shaking toe is the, oh, we just sit and observe what arises and passes as, you know, a sensation coming in through the six sense doors as pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. And, you know, states skew to that practice.
But the question is, do we have to intentionally direct our attention to observe this?
Or does it just happen?
But after 3 months on a retreat, is that actually what you end up kind of naturally seeing on your own? That's just the unfolding of it. But what I appreciate very much is both Michelle and you pointing out the kind of how human it is to get, you know, even Sakka. So it's kind of inspiring now to hear you guys' interpretation. Even Sakka, who was a stream mentor, can lose track of all this. So how much, if he can do it, so much more us. So let's be really careful. Let's be really careful. Let's not spend too much time in palaces. Palatial amnesia, is that your word, Michelle?
Palace-induced amnesia.
Great. And Bonnie, from your palace there.
Hi, Gil. I'm really appreciating what Ash and Mike just said. I was so struck by the instructions that were given to Sakka about not being attached to anything. And then very ironically, Sakka was not even attached to the teachings. He just let everything go, but that was not the point. So it brought up to me the whole question of how does one hold the teachings? And as you described, of course, the teachings hold you when you're on a long retreat. But in the daily life, it's like one doesn't grasp them. You have to find some other way of abiding with them. My mind just began to kind of play with this holding and grasping and attaching and in regard to the teachings.
Yeah, this is very interesting to hear this. And I was looking back at what I read earlier, where the Buddha is giving Mahamogalyana this teaching on bonding. I don't know what the Pali is. I want to go back and see now. But from this the Numerical Discourse 761, the Buddha said to Mogalyana, I do not praise bonding with everyone whatsoever, nor do I praise bonding with no one at all. I do not praise bonding with householders or monastics, but I do praise bonding with quiet and noiseless lodgings, far from the flurry of people, remote from human habitation, and suitable for seclusion. So when I heard what you said, Bonnie, maybe there's a healthy bonding to the teaching that is not exactly the same as clinging. And that's not what we have Sakka doing, as you said. You know, he just kind of like said, you know, says great, and he has important duties to do, hang out with his maidens. Thank you. So then part of the challenge for people like me who's trying to have a real wish to try to understand the historical layering of these texts and when they were written, it's a kind of a fool's errand because it's so hard to do and really hard to do well. If you try to understand when Majjhima 37 might have been composed, one of the things that we quickly see is that there's a really wide range of time in which it was possible to have been composed, and we can't really know in that range. And it might be like a, you know, it might be a, you know, 600 year period where there's kind of a black hole in time where we don't really know where and when it was composed and when it was composed in its current form. Because these texts were changing so much in ancient India, some of these texts have so many surviving versions of them. I think the Angulimala Sutta, there are 17 different versions of the Angulimala Sutta. Which one is the real one? You know, which one, you know, is the Pali one any realer than the others? And it turns out that the Angulimala Sutta, the Pali version, is one of those Pali texts that's constructed as a chiasmus. The same structure there as well. And I used to read the Angulimala Sutta and thought it was kind of a strange, disjointed bunch of vignettes. And then when I saw the structure, I saw that it fits perfectly. It's very tightly and carefully constructed to be this perfect chiasmic structure for all kinds of reasons. And you know, 17 different versions of them. Some of them are very, very simple of the Angulimala Sutta. So I kind of like to think that when you have this storyteller's technique that's used so beautifully, that it probably is many, many centuries after the Buddha. After a time when suttas were being recorded or written down, composed, memorized, among the monastic community as simply a way of organizing the Buddha's teachings, to a time when suttas were used not just for monastics in their own study, but in order to be able to present the Dharma to you know, much wider range of people than just to Buddhas, just to monastics, maybe a popular audience. Maybe there were storytellers who wandered around and told these entertaining suttas for the laity. And what was the purpose of some of these suttas? It was to inspire people with wonder and awe. And back in ancient India, issues of power and awe, psychic power, were pretty prominent and interesting for people. And so we see that this whole thing with Mahamogliana, one of the maybe precursor texts for it. The Buddha even describes what it took for Mahamogliana to develop his psychic powers. And that's the only purpose of the text. You know, it's just a short little text, and it's just laying out this is what you do. And as if this was an important thing. So here we see that in Majjhima 37, after Mahamogliana shakes the palace, Sakha's maidens are in awe and wonder at what has just happened. And they express their wonder at the power of some monk who can do that. And then even more amazement that the teacher for Mahamogliana, he must really be powerful. So this idea of power again as something that maybe became more important for popular audience of people who were, or an audience of people for whom maybe enlightenment wasn't so prominent as an interest for them, but spiritual power and what was powerful was of interest to them because they worshiped them, they got merit with them. And Sakha himself was, as Indra, was a very important god in ancient India, modern India as well. And there were temples within to Indra, there was people worshiping Indra. And I wouldn't be surprised if Sakha, as a Buddhist god, was present in, you know, little altars or little shrines to Sakha in some of these Buddhist shrine places. And he was adopted into the Buddhist worldview. And because that's what people wanted or expected, or there was already a strong orientation around it, around this god. So when was this Majjhima 37 written? How was it composed? I've offered you some ideas. I think that the primary takeaway for me is that this text was composed as in its current form many centuries after the Buddha. And it's a carefully constructed text. There was a lot of thought and care that went into how it was put together. And so we see the craftsmanship, the craftsmanship of the people who did it. And some of it is quite beautifully done. And so what perspective does that provide us for the other suttas? One of them for me is to be careful not to assume too easily that any sutta you're reading contains the teachings of the historical Buddha. It certainly may, but I think we have to have a little question mark behind us and to be willing to look at this these texts for how they support our practice, how they support our way of seeing and understanding in dharmic ways and ways that are freeing and liberating for us, and be careful that we don't get too fundamentalist around this is the truth, this is what the Buddha taught, which I kind of think is kind of a non-Buddhist thing to do. So hopefully this was interesting for you, and to get this kind of glimpse into these texts, and maybe it's different than how most of you have looked at these texts before. And so I thank you for listening and being here. So now it's time to stop it, because I said I would meet with these people in the certificate program for half an hour, and some of them have been doing a more in-depth study of the Majjhima, so they probably have other things to say. So for the rest of you, thank you very much for being part of it. And maybe if there's interest in this kind of things, we'll do something like this again.